Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Prove Me Wrong podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Pete Leeb. I am glad you're with me again tonight. I have a fun show tonight, I think. You know by now, I'm a huge fan of rock and roll. I've had several podcasts now revolving around the life and times of different rock icons. Most recently, I've spoken with Ivor Davis about life on tour with the Beatles in 1964. And we also had a podcast recently about the book Van Halen Rising. Those are arguably two of the biggest rock and roll bands in England and the United States. And tonight, I am excited to be able to talk about what I would consider to be the greatest rock and roll band from Australia, and that's AC/DC. Specifically, we'll discuss tonight the driving forces of the band, the Young Brothers, Malcolm and Angus, as well as older brother George, who many casual fans of the band may not even know existed, quite honestly, because he wasn't directly on stage with the others. But he was an accomplished musician in his own right and very instrumental in the long-term success of the band. To discuss the Youngs tonight with me is my guest, Mr. Jeff Apter. Jeff is an author of more than 25 books, including biographies of the Finn Brothers, and my American friends may know them best from the band Crowded House, the Bee Gees, Jeff Buckley, and Keith Urban, among many others. Our discussion tonight will encompass three biographies focused on the Young Brothers. And actually, if you are looking on the YouTube and or Rumble versions of the video cast right now, I have the covers of those books right now flashing on screen. They include number one bestseller, High Voltage, The Life of Angus Young, AC/DC's Last Man Standing, Malcolm Young, The Man Who Made AC/DC, and most recently, Friday on My Mind, The Life of George Young, which was published in August of this year, 2020. Now, with time constraints of the show, we're not digging in deep with all of these tonight, but instead kind of wetting the whistle for all of you out there in radio land to run out to your nearest internet-capable device and order your copies online, and they'll be delivered right to your door, and you can continue the journey there. Jeff has been writing for more than 25 years, having spent 4 years on staff at Australian Rolling Stone, and has been a frequent contributor to The Bulletin, Vogue, GQ, and Sydney Morning Herald, among many others. You can find Jeff online at jeffapter.com.au, where you can purchase his books, or you can also find those as well on amazon.com. So, all the way from New South Wales, South Coast, Australia, where if you are living in the U.S. like I am, it's already tomorrow. Welcome, Jeff, to the podcast.
Hi, Pete. Thanks for the invite, and great to be here.
It's kind of interesting. I've had the privilege of speaking with, I think, three Aussies at this point in my career here with the podcast. And it's always fun to see myself in the future. I'm seeing myself right now at, 11 o'clock tomorrow. It's great.
Tomorrow's good. It's clear. The sun's shining. But I can't tell you the result of the election yet. Okay?
That was my second question. Actually, I wasn't sure if I was talking into the future or if, unfortunately, you're just reliving the past. If you're looking back and talking to me.
For your sake, I hope you don't relive the past.
Absolutely. So please, if you would, fill me in a little more on your story, Jeff, and what led you to become a writer and ultimately involved in, you chronicle a lot of the Australian music scene. What got you started?
Sure. Well, look, I'm a Sydney-sider. Now, Sydney... And growing up in the 70s in Sydney, it was just a great place for music. There was live music every night of the week. There were a lot of great bands, many of who went on to international success. It was the time of, you know, Midnight Oil, AC/DC, of course, In Excess. A lot of these bands came out of this really rich and fertile period in Australian music when it was possible, probably for the first time, for bands to make a living. They could tour. They could play 7 nights a week. They could tour around the country. There were these big beer barns, what we call beer barns opening, you know, 1,000 capacity rooms. And it was really the breeding ground for so many of these bands. And it was the environment that I grew up in. It was just such a great time. And at the same time, you know, I'm a teenager. And interestingly, all my friends and I seem to have older siblings with really good taste.
Yeah.
One guy's older brother was into Lou Reed. Another one was into Bowie. My older brother was into all the British Invasion bands. So we're taking in all this international stuff, as well as going out 2-3 times a week to see great local bands. So I came up through this really vibrant musical time in the 70s and 80s, not just in Sydney, but all across Australia. It really was a really great time, and I was very fortunate in that regard. It took me a little while to get into writing. I stumbled around a bunch of kind of boring white collar jobs, but always with this goal I didn't want to be a performer. I had no interest in that, but I enjoyed writing and I loved music. And I was just trying to find a way to combine the two. And I happened upon a book called No One Here Gets Out Alive, which is written by Jerry Hopkins. It's about Jim Morrison and the Doors.
Right.
And it remains to this day probably the best music bio I've ever read. And it opened my eyes. I thought it's possible to write about music in a serious way and to be regarded in a serious way. Whereas before, you know, books about music always seem to be like scrapbooks. They weren't serious, you know. And that book really opened my eyes. And eventually I got started. My start was purely by chance. I read a review of, I think it was an REM record, wrote to the magazine editor, said, "You haven't got a clue. You don't know what you're talking about." And instead of him just throwing it in the bin, he actually challenged me. He said, "Well, if you're so smart, why don't you write some record reviews?" And that's how I got my start. Eventually in the mid 90s, through a series of strange life changes, I went to America, lived there for a couple of years, was in Connecticut for most of the time, but traveled around and got the opportunity because I was then sending articles back to magazines in Australia. I got the chance to meet people like Aretha Franklin and Robbie Robertson from the band, and Patti Smith, all these icons, and write about them. Bob Dylan, I remember once seeing a university show. Bob Dylan was playing there, and we walked into the grounds, and there was Bob in his trailer watching The Simpsons. And I thought, this is just too weird for words, you know. So I had all these great experiences, came back to Australia in the late 90s, and as you mentioned, got a job with Rolling Stone here. And I had this, by then I had a good bag of tricks, I guess. And I spent the next 4 years really working, kind of nurturing this idea of writing books, writing more long form. And when I finished 4 years there, that's how I got started. My first book was actually about the band Silverchair, who were one of the more recent Australian bands to make a big impact in America. And it's just gone from there. You know, I've kept going for the last, it's almost 20 years now I've been writing books. And, you know, most of them have been really well received. I'm lucky enough to keep getting work.
Yeah.
But I realized I did write a few books on international acts, but there was a real awakening for me just at a point where I thought, you know, I know so much more about Australian music than I do about, I think I wrote a book on the Red Hot Chili Peppers, for instance. And I knew so much more about Australian acts than I did about international acts. And I decided this is a few books into my career to really just focus on local artists. And that was great for me because I was able to draw on all that stuff I was telling you about growing up in Sydney in the 70s and 80s. So now I was writing about the bands that I saw as a teenager in my early 20s. So I was drawing on a lot of personal experience. So I was a sort of, it's a long and winding road, but it got me here.
You said something really interesting to me, and to me it's super true. And it's about having those influences when you're young, getting lucky and having those people who ultimately we're listening to, you know, that the music of the time and what would really shape you. And I was also one of those people who, I was an only child, but I had some older cousins, and my older cousins were listening to the James Gang and Queen and so all of those bands that, and AC/DC at that point. And so I was introduced to that stuff by them, you know, Van Halen, Rolling Stones. And so I was very lucky because I could have been with, I don't trust people, first of all, I don't trust people who don't listen to music in the car. If you don't listen to music in the car, I don't trust you. There's something wrong there. Yeah. Or people who say, "I don't really like music." I don't know.
I'll add pets to that. I'm a bit wary of people without pets.
Yeah, or who your pet doesn't like. If your dog doesn't like somebody.
Well, that's true, too.
If their dog doesn't like somebody, that's a red flag, big time.
Yeah, gotcha.
But you're right. I mean, people get really lucky sometimes, and they have somebody else who can say, "Hey, take a listen to this. This is going to change your life." And a lot of times it does. What was your first experience with AC/DC like?
Well, it's really funny. There's a TV show here called Countdown, and I guess the American equivalent would be something like, it's not quite Midnight Special, it's more like Solid Gold. Remember Solid Gold?
Yeah.
It was a show in the 80s.
Absolutely.
You know, and it would have the top 10, I think, at the end of the show, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was very much, it was actually based on a British show called Top of the Pops. And Top of the Pops was strictly a pop show, but you had to be on the charts to be in the show. And AC/DC were almost the house band for this show. It started in really came to fruition early 75, 76. Countdown was the must watch show on TV. It screened 6 o'clock on a Sunday night, just the time you were probably recovering from Saturday night,
right?
Or sitting down to dinner with your folks, and you had to watch it. And some of the early AC/DC appearances on that are just fantastic, because they took Angus in particular and just made him the kind of court jester for the show. He was dressed, once he was dressed as Zorro, another time he was in a Superman outfit. And anybody who's seen Angus, he does not have the build of Superman, you know. So there are these really funny clips. And with Bon Scott out the front, there was one classic episode where he came out in drag.
Yeah, I saw that.
Cigarette hanging out the corner of his mouth, you know, the ugliest woman you've ever seen in your life, you know. And so that made a real big impression. And they were playing a show in Sydney, and it was Australia. It was the end of January 1977. And I was still underage. I was only 15, 16 at the time. And my friends and I, we'd go into the city, and the standard procedure was the oldest guy or the guy with the most facial hair in the group would go into a pub and get everybody drinks, and we'd all stand outside. And we heard about this show, and we said, oh, we're going to go and see AC/DC. Great. So we got down there, and of course, we couldn't get in. It was a full house. So my first experience of AC/DC was through a brick wall. And they were playing so loudly, it didn't really matter, because they were just tearing the walls down. It was fantastic. And, you know, that was when, to me, they were really at their prime. Bon Scott out front, Angus and Malcolm really tearing it up. Mark Evans, who I had the good luck of later writing a book with, on bass, Phil Rudd playing drums. And they were just fantastic. And they were a part of the furniture, really, part of the fabric of the musical community here in Australia in the 70s. You know, they were the leading lights because they'd gone to England, they'd had some success, then they went to America, but they always came back to Australia, and their tours were always must-sees. Mm-hmm. You know, they were really, because they were the Australian band blazing a trail internationally for other Australian bands to follow. And if you look, historically speaking, they were soon followed by INXS, Midnight Oil, people like Rick Springfield, you know, who went overseas and had huge success. All came out of that same musical background. So they were real trailblazers. So like going back to my first experience was through a brick wall, and it still sounded fantastic.
It's funny is that, again, one of my first earliest memories involves AC/DC, and it's super weird. I mean, this is probably also 77, and I'm a little bit younger. So to me, 77, 78, I was probably about 6 years old. And I remember very clearly sitting in the back, my uncle had a chocolate brown Camaro, and I'm sitting in the back seat of his chocolate brown Camaro, and TNT is just blasting out of his, you know, I got my head sticking out the window, and I'm watching people as we drive down the street, you know, down High Street in Columbus, and TNT is just blasting out of his stereo, and just that, oi, oi, you know, that noise, and I was just digging it, and I was just like, oh my goodness, and it's one of the lasting memories of my life. I don't have a whole lot of memories from that time, but I remember sitting in the back of his car thinking I was the coolest thing around because he had a chocolate Camaro, and listening to, you know, AC, I'm just pumping my fist out the window as they're going, oi, 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 you know.
Oh, yeah. Where I grew up, you'd hear that pouring out of windows of cars all the time. Absolutely. It was, you know, because it just sounded great. Great driving music, you know, really physical, really dynamic, and really good loud. It sounded really good loud.
Absolutely.
You know? So, you know, it covered every base for a teenage kid growing up here, as I'm sure it did for you as well.
So it just speaks again to the power of music. Every time I hear that song, even today, you know, 40 years later, I am thinking of sitting in the back of that car the first time you really heard it and recognized what you were hearing. So it just sticks with me.
So yeah, the memory for me is trying to talk my way into the venue, which was standing on the other side of the brick wall.
So, yeah, exactly.
Come on, man, let us in. Let us in. We're okay, because we're drunk on our two beers by then.
Yeah.
Yeah, still, it's you know, I found myself drawing on that quite a bit lately because it's just a funny experience. But it says a lot about how loudly they played. You know, they really played with a lot of power.
What was early life like in the Young house? They had the three brothers, at least those three brothers, who were all working on their music, working on playing guitar. They all played guitar, right? Did they have formal training? What was that the Young house like when they were young?
It's a really interesting family story. When they immigrated, post-war, there was a scheme to bring immigrants into Australia to work in things like coal mines and factories and, you know, basically all these new industries that were starting here. They had a thing called the 10-pound POM scheme, which meant for 10 English pounds, you could bring your entire family and settle in Australia.
Wow.
So that meant there were hundreds of thousands of immigrants. And of course, post-war England, post-war Europe, the one place you wanted to be was somewhere far away. And Australia was this great attractor. This scheme, by the way, I mean, it led to people, not just the Young brothers, but Olivia Newton-John was another. You know, Glenn Sharp from the Easy from the Little River Band, a whole bunch. Hugh Jackman, the actor. You know, so many famous people, famous Australians, came to Australia as a result of this scheme. And the Youngs were, there was 10 of the Youngs came over. They were a big family, wow, big Scottish clan. But back in the UK, one of the older brothers, Alex, was actually in a band by this time. This is early 1960s. He's in a band called Grapefruit, who, and I love this, they signed to Apple. How perfect is that? And, you know, so that's a bit, I mean, joking aside, that's a big accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? So George looked on. George was 15, 16 years old at this point. He's looking on going, this is pretty impressive. This is great. That's what I want to do. But at the same time, because he was so young, the whole family, except for Alex, who stayed behind in the UK, emigrated to Australia. And they ended up, the ads said, come to the sunny side, you know, wonderful Australia. They ended up in a migrant hostel, which is now a detention center and a really notorious detention center for refugees in outer Sydney. So, you know, they were expecting the beach. They're expecting, mm-hmm, they got a lot of sunshine, but unfortunately it was accompanied by snakes, spiders, angry locals who weren't happy to have a migrant hostel in the middle of their sleepy suburb. But the really interesting thing was there was a lot of young kids in similar situations there. And that's where George met Harry Vander. And that's where the band, the Easy Beats, emerged from. And by the mid-60s, the Easy Beats were Australia's biggest act. They were huge. They were the only Australian band having success with original material. They were real trailblazers, mm-hmm, hugely inspired by the Beatles and all those British invasion bands at the time. Malcolm and Angus, meanwhile, they're just kids. But they're looking on as brother George is one of the most famous guys in Australia. And they'd only been in the country for 18 months.
Wow.
And it was big. It was Beatlemania kind of level of success. Their shows would be, the stage would be invaded. There'd be screaming girls. Angus and Malcolm would get back to their home. And they'd moved out of the migrant hostel and moved into a very sleepy suburb called Burwood, where actually I used to live. And about 15 minutes out of town, but it's really just it's another Sydney suburb.
Yeah.
And they get home from school and there'd be hundreds of girls on their front lawn, you know, because they'd found out that George lived there. George still lived with his parents. And, you know, they'd be like, what the hell is this? And there's a great story about Angus coming home from school and there's police on the front lawn and there's girls everywhere. And he's trying to convince them that he lived there, but the police wouldn't have a bar of it and said, sorry, mate, you know, everybody here tells me they live there too.
Right.
So Angus used to have to jump the back fence to get into his own house. But quite often they'd find girls in the cupboard and girls under the bed and they'd have to chase them out of the house with a broom, you know. So it was madness. But can you imagine being a teenager and seeing your big brother achieving this and thinking, oh, man, I want a slice of that too. That looks pretty good. So ultimately the Easy Beats went to the UK. They had a huge international hit in 1966 with Friday on My Mind,
yeah,
which I'm sure absolutely most people know. Yeah. Then spent another 3 or 4 years trying to reproduce the success, but not having any success at the same level. Came back to Australia, and George became the mentor for Malcolm and Angus when they did form AC/DC. Not just the mentor, but he became their record producer with Harry Vander, his old partner from the Easy Beats. So there's this wonderful kind of clannish thing going on with the Young Brothers and those few people that they let into their inner circle. And that really was right through to the time of Highway to Hell, which is the late 70s. George and Harry Vander produced all the AC/DC records, and they were really done in a very clannish young brother kind of way. You know, the three of them, there's a wonderful photo that I was sent of the three of them sitting in this studio. And by the way, when George returned to Australia in 1973, part of the allure was the fact that the Easy Beats record company there, the owner of the company, built a studio for him and Harry Vander to work in, their own recording studio, and mm-hmm, a state-of-the-art studio. So it was a great attractor. And that's where all these early AC/DC records were made. And there's a wonderful photo of the three brothers, Malcolm, Angus, and George, sitting at a piano, playing together, banging out a song, because George used to say to them, bring whatever songs you've got into the studio, and if we can play it on the piano, it's ready to record.
Wow.
Now, think about it. TNT, High Voltage, Long Way to the Top, all these songs that are signature guitar rock and roll songs were actually banged out on the piano, you know, because they had a piano back at the house in Burwood as well. So it was like George's litmus test. If it flies on the piano, it works in the studio.
Were they trained musicians or did they just learn on their own?
No, they were rock and rollers through and through. You know,
just learned
by ear.
And that's so amazing.
Great players. Became great players.
That's so amazing. You know, while I appreciate Angus, Malcolm to me was so amazing. I mean, as just a rhythm player, and he was just boom, banging that out. That's what I really appreciate almost more, because it takes a lot to be a great rhythm player. I mean, it really does. It's an underappreciated skill.
There's a theory. The only other job he held down apart from being a musician was working in the Burley Bra Factory in suburban Sydney, where there'd be a lot of machinery. And there's a theory that the sound of that machinery really got into his head, because if you listen, he does play in a very... I won't say mechanical way, but it's almost like industrial strength, you know? And so there's a theory that some of that kind of eked into his subconscious and came out in his playing, which I think is a really, it may not be true, but it's a great theory.
But it just always seems so tight. I mean, it always just seems so tight between him and I always loved the drum as well, because the drummer.
Bill Rutt.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what I've always said to somebody, because a lot of drummers, they want to be all over the place. And I'm like, man, I want the AC/DC sound. I want the Timekeeper. Give me that nice, steady, you know, that powerful beat. You don't have to show off for me.
Yeah, George, Big Brother George played a key role in this, because George, when the Easy Beats fell apart in the late 60s, he came to the realization that what the mistake that they made is they were probably too influenced by the Beatles. They'd watched the Beatles be very experimental. You know, the difference between Love Me Do and A Day in the Life is you know, eons.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
And he saw this and went, well, we should try that too. But what happened was they moved away from that signature sound that was in Friday on My Mind, and they got into a whole bunch of different things, and they sort of lost their musical identity. So early on, when Malcolm and Angus formed AC/DC and they're working in the studio with George, they said to him, because he was their mentor, they always came to him for advice, and they said, should we be a bit more experimental? And he said, no. He said, you're one of the luckiest bands I know, because you found your sound early on. And the sound that they had was the sound that was heard in all these pubs and clubs that I was talking about earlier. Because Australian audiences, they like to drink and they like loud rock and roll. And if you look at some of the bands we've produced, there's evidence of that, AC/DC being a classic example, but also people like Rose Tattoo, Midnight Oil, all these bands that have had, Silverchair, another good example, you know, have had really big international success, learned how to play hard and loud in these pubs. And that's what AC/DC really tried to do with those early records. And George said to them, don't waver from that. You've got your sound. Stick with it. You know, try to push it as far as you can, but stick within that boundary of two guitars, drum, bass, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, in Bon Scott, the best singer Australia ever produced, and probably the best lyricist as well. Funny, rude, raunchy, and sometimes really insightful, you know? So they really had the works. But going back to George, his role was monumental in that he would often give the band, his brothers particularly, advice about what not to do. When it comes to, we're talking about Malcolm's playing,
right.
George said to him, it's the stop that rocks. What he meant, it's the space between the notes.
Yes.
It's taking those pauses, letting it breathe, and then keep playing. And if you listen to Malcolm's style on, you know, right through to classics like Back in Black, it's very much like that. He's not playing 100 notes. He's not flailing away. He's just playing a very focused and concentrated and specific notes. It's really, it was great advice, and it became that signature AC/DC sound.
Well, in your book on Malcolm, the subtitle was the man who made AC/DC, and he's always been, to me, again, the backbone of the group, but many would be surprised that he was the driving force. Can you go into his role in the formation of the band?
Sure. Malcolm had played in oddly enough, he played in, as a teenager, in a, what was more of a pop band called the Velvet Underground. Nothing to do with Lou Reed's band, but they'll call the Velvet Underground because I think they both read the same book, basically. And he always wanted to have his own band. In that band, he was really just a high rhythm guitarist. Angus, meanwhile, had played in one or two bands, but, you know, with no real success. And it seemed inevitable that they join forces. Malcolm, being the slightly older of the two, he was very driven. And you have to realize that the Youngs had no other option but to be in a rock and roll band because they weren't particularly well educated. They'd finished what we call school certificate, which is year 10. I'm not sure where that fits within the American system, but, you know, so they did 10 years of school, basically.
Okay.
They left, which in Australia was enough to get you a job working as a tradesman, you know, a carpenter or electrician or something like that. And they both tried very briefly to fit in with the normal working world, and that wasn't for them. So they only had rock and roll. There was no fallback plan. It wasn't like they had a teaching degree or something that they could go back to. So, you know, and Malcolm very clearly understood that and realized that we have to make AC/DC work. There's a great story that proves how driven he was, is when Mark Evans joined the band as bass player, and this is March 75. Malcolm pulled him aside and said, just so you know, in a year's time, we're going to be based in London. And Mark's thinking, we're just still playing pubs to 100 people, you know. And as Mark wrote in his terrific book called Dirty Deeds, he said, he said, Malcolm was wrong. It was a year and a week. You know, he was that driven. He really knew what he was going to do and how he was going to get there. He was ambitious and he had steely determination. He was off stage. He was a lot like he was on stage.
And these guys were mid teenagers, right? It wasn't Angus something like 15 when he joined? I mean,
His age varied depending on which journalist he was talking to. But yeah, they were certainly teenagers when the band started. And by the time they got to the UK, which was the start of that big international touring, that's 1976. From memory, Angus is still a teenager and Malcolm would have been early 20s. So kids, still kids.
Yes. So even then, you know, a couple of years, it's amazing to me that you're talking about the focus that they had at that age. You know, we're going to be here in a couple of years. I have a 19-year-old right now. I have a 17-year-old daughter, or an 18-year-old daughter right now. They can barely get out of their own way, right? So it's amazing to me that just the different times. These guys knew what they wanted to do at that time, and they knew, and they had the plan, and they were ready to execute it.
But, you know, working class, that's important. You know, these guys knew that this was their big opportunity. And Australia's a small, particularly then, as great as it was for me as a kid growing up, a teenager growing up, it was still for a band, there's probably only 20, 25 rooms you could play around the country. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a tour. So, you know, you can't just keep playing them over and over again. Right. And if you look through AC/DC's early history, they played everywhere. You know, talk about weddings, parties, anything. You know, they'd play school halls. They'd play three or four shows in a day.
Wow.
You know, they'd play anywhere they could have. But they knew, in the same way that Big Brother George had taken the Easy Beats overseas in 1966, they knew that was a rite of passage too for Australian musicians, Australian writers, Australian artists and actors in the 60s to go to London particularly, because firstly, it was swinging London, the 60s, it was a great time. And secondly, it was much easier to get a working visa because it's part of the Commonwealth. And nothing much had changed by the time AC/DC did that in 1976. It's much easier to start an international career for an Australian in the UK and then go to America than it is trying to get into America, get a green card and get started. So, you know, there was a bit of pragmatism to it as well.
Yeah. So when you think of the band now, when somebody would think of the band right now, they're thinking Angus Young first. I mean, they are thinking of him as the figurehead. But that wasn't, but to me, that wasn't always the way it was. When I was coming up, and again, I'm with you, when I became aware, Bon Scott was the man. Oh, to me, he was the figurehead. He was the man.
Yes.
So when Angus first started, what was his role in the band? And I mean, obviously, again, Bon at that point was the leader. What was his role at first before he was really kind of thrust? He had to be thrust into that once Bon unfortunately passed.
Yeah, look, I mean, keep in mind too, there was a guy called Dave Evans before Bon Scott. He was in the band for probably their first, I think it's the first 9 or 10 months. And by, you know, Angus, he was, like I say, he's just a kid, but he was always the crazy schoolboy guitarist. He knew his role from day one was to be, you know, this manic guitarist. I mean, I've been given stories about he'd run around, he'd show people his licks in their house at Burwood, and he'd do the same stage antics that he did if he was playing to 5,000 people. He'd do it in his bedroom, you know, jumping around and leaping. Sometimes he recorded that way too. It was just the way he played.
Yeah.
So he always had that in him, you know, that crazy schoolboy thing. But I think once Bon joined the band, and I've described it in various books as the Bon and Angus show, you know, Bon had seen, and this is really significant, Bon had been in the UK with an earlier band that he was in called Fraternity. And they'd seen Brian Johnson play in a band called Geordie. And this is 1972. They'd seen Brian pick up the guitarist, hoist him on his shoulders and run around the venue. And Bon went, I like the looks of that. That looks like a really good trick.
Yeah.
And of course, with little Angus, he said, great, the perfect guy. A, he's light. And B, he's a really good player. And that became a big part of the Bon and Angus show, which really carried them right through to Highway to Hell. You know, to me, they were the central focus. Angus's role was always going to be, he was the Malcolm used to say that Angus can have the pointy end of the stage. I'm happy with that, where the spotlight is. I'm happy to be up at the quiet end, up the back. You know? And if you look at them up on stage, that's literally how they worked. Malcolm stood back next to the drum riser, as did Mark Evans and then Cliff Williams on bass. And every now and again, Malcolm would move forward to shout out a few backing vocals and then step right back and leave Angus and Bond to dominate the stage. All the pieces just work so perfectly for me.
So you said they went to the UK in the mid 70s. When did they really start to gain traction worldwide? I know Back in Black was, to me, when they really exploded in the United States. But we knew them before that. When did they start to really gain some traction?
Well, they didn't leave Australia until they had an international record deal. So when they went to the UK in 76, I think it was April 76, they already had a deal with Atlantic Records. Mm-hmm. They had an international record deal. And that was important because at least it gave them a starting point, because most Australian bands who go and relocate to the UK, and nowadays more likely the US, quite often will do it and have to start from scratch, which is true as far as a touring band is concerned for AC/DC, but they did have a record deal. That was important. So, you know, they had that base. And also that meant that the opportunity to eventually tour America, which was the next stepping stone for them, was present. They could do that. But they really had to, again, they really had to reintroduce themselves, I guess. There were some people who already knew about them in the UK, but not a lot. They just played and played and played. They would play every night of the week, basically. If you look, there's some great websites that have, you know, their tour history dating back to 73, 74. I've never seen a band that played so much as AC/DC. You know, to do 200 shows a year would actually be a quiet year for them.
Wow.
You know, it was amazing. In those early years, they'd be doing 250 shows a year and recording an album and writing a new one and doing all the promotion that came with it and doing videos and all the things that are required. They never stopped. You know, it was really interesting for me to work with Mark Evans, their bassist, because he said, oh, we got a weekly work schedule. You know, basically said where we were going, where the gigs were, what time we needed to be there, what promo we needed to do. And he said it never stopped. It just kept coming week after week after week. So that, and again, it goes back to this work ethic, this working class ethic about put in, you work hard. And that's certainly what AC/DC did. It took them a while to establish themselves in the UK because of punk. You know, they were definitely not a punk band. So they didn't really fit. And the British music press is a particularly fickle beast. And at that time, it was all about Sex Pistols, Clash, Damned, and so on. And, you know, there's some great quotes from AC/DC, the guys, particularly Bon, saying, you know, punk is the last thing we are. You know, we're a lot tougher than some guys just sticks a bobby pin through his cheek. You know, that's nothing to us. You know, so they but gradually found an audience, gone to America, and did the same thing over again.
Yeah, the amazing thing to me is you mentioned that working class ethos, and that was, to me, was always the appeal of the band. They seem so relatable to me personally.
Unpretentious.
Yeah. And to your point, they had to weather several industry altering changes, shifts. You know, they went from punk to the glam metal, which they were not. They were not glam metal. They were not Poison or one of those type of bands. Then to grunge, they went through the whole grunge area, and they were still relevant in the 90s and in the early 90s as well. When grunge put everybody else out of business, they kept right on going, and they maintained their relevance. And I think it is that you feel you can connect with these guys.
The audience is loyal. Yeah, there's a kind of funny gag in Australia that, you know, I'm 58, and the people my age who we've been AC/DC fans for 40 years, we're now just wearing bigger T-shirts.
Yeah.
That's basically it. You rusted on. And a lot of people are incredibly loyal. They did. I found it was really interesting that, post Back in Black, they didn't sell the records in the same quantity ever again. But who does?
Right.
You know, when you've got one of the 10 best-selling albums of all time, it's pretty hard to match. But what they did do is become a bigger live draw card. The numbers for their last three or four tours are staggering. It's Rolling Stones numbers, you know. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars revenue. You know, it's absolutely amazing. Playing to crowds of 50,000 upwards, you know, when they were nurtured in a scene where they're playing to 100 people in a pub somewhere in suburban Sydney, you know, and 30, 40 years later, they're playing arenas all around the world. And interestingly to me, playing a lot of songs that date back to that original Bon Scott era. Their songs have never left their set. You know, Highway to Hell, Long Way to the Top, TNT, Dirty Deeds, you know, you name it. If you look at a set list from, well, I assume they're about to tour again in support of this new record when they can, you'll probably see 50 or 60% of the set list will be songs from the Bon Scott era.
And I can hear in your voice, your reverence for Bon and the way you feel about Bon. What was the effect of his death on those other members of the band at the time?
Well, I mean, I think, and you know, broadly, people thought it was all over.
Yeah.
And they really did. I mean, how do you replace a guy like that?
Right.
And, you know, great, like I said, great lyricist, incredibly charismatic, fantastic on stage. And he had this thing with Angus, this amazing double act, you know, up on his shoulders and carrying him around the venue and just really interacting and connecting with an audience. That's a hard act to follow. But the story and the truth of the matter is, Angus and Malcolm were at Bon's funeral in Western Australia, a place called Fremantle. They sat down with Bon's parents, and these guys were distraught. They'd lost essentially an elder brother in Bon, although they used to call him the mad uncle in the band. But, you know, they'd lost someone they were deeply connected to. And they said, we don't know what to do. And Bon's parents said, keep going. Keep going. If you could possibly keep going, do it. And like I said before, it's not as though Malcolm and Angus had other choices in life.
Right.
They only had the band. And, you know, so they had that reassurance, that vote of confidence. It's okay. If you can find someone to keep going with, do it. And, of course, Bon had told them about Brian Johnson because he'd seen him with Geordie carrying the guitarist around on his shoulders, you know, 8 years ago. So it was a sort of a perfect storm for Brian Johnson that he was on the list of people that Bon said, look, if anything ever happens to me, I think you should look at this guy. And while as a lyricist, he's not a notch on Bon, you know, and as a front man, he's great, but he's not, he's just not as physical as Bon Scott was,
right.
I think is the best way to describe it. But he's managed to carry that band, you know, for the next 40 years. He's done a huge thing. And it was a big, Bon was a hard act to follow. You know, it really was. A lot of it, so them continuing really was about Bon's parents saying, it's okay, we understand. It's your band. If you want to keep it going, we're okay with that. You just have to find the right guy. And they did. They did.
Very few bands, I can think of two, very few bands have been able to replace a lead singer and maintain popularity. And maintain.
Have you watched In Excess over the last 20 years?
I mean, to me,
it's a horror show.
Exactly. To me, it was Van Halen who was able to replace David Lee Roth. And while, again, Sammy Hagar on his best day as a front man is not David Lee Roth.
I love Diamond Dave.
Yeah, he is not David Lee Roth. David Lee Roth is, in my opinion, was the greatest front man of all time. Mm-hmm. But they still had. You know, I always tell the story about the 5150, and my mom bought it for me for Christmas. I refused to listen to it for 3 months. I was so upset. When I finally heard it, and I heard that, why can't this be love? And I was then I was mad because it was so good. I'm like, oh my God, this is so good. So I was mad that it wasn't David, and then I was mad that it was good. But the point is, Brian then comes in, and he's able to not only maintain, but in a lot of respects, Back in Black, for those about to rock, those type of, you know, those were some of the biggest albums that they ever did. But do you have, and this is my question, I know people who have friendships made and lost on the Sammy or Dave Lee Roth question.
Sure.
So the first thing you do is, are you a Dave guy or are you a Sammy guy? If he says you're a Sammy guy, we're not friends. Is something like that, I mean, obviously the situation's different because Bon passed. He didn't leave the band. But is there that question in Australia about Bon Scott, Brian Johnson?
I think if you did a poll amongst Australian AC/DC fans of a certain age, don't get me wrong, I mean, that's something we should talk about too, the fact that AC/DC audiences have gotten younger over the years, bizarrely. You know, people bring their kids now. But certainly guys like me who have been around for long enough to remember them at the start are almost universally going to be from the Bon Scott side of things. But not dismissive of you know, the last 40 years, don't get me wrong. I mean, there's been a number of great songs and one particularly great album came out of that. And the simple fact that they've been able to continue going is amazing. And, you know, Australians take a lot of pride in the fact that AC/DC, a band that was born in the Sydney suburbs in a housing commission, you know, in a very cheap and working class environment, have become perhaps the most bankable band in the world.
Absolutely.
It's a massive achievement. So, yeah, but yeah, look, the purists will certainly I mean, there's a lot of people too, but not in Australia, I don't think. I think the feelings, the that same kind of commitment to Brian Johnson typically comes from people who were introduced to the band probably from Back in Black onwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes perfect sense. You know, there's no harm in that. I mean, God, if that was the first record you heard, it wasn't a bad one. I mean, it was a fantastic album.
Honestly, you know? I think Back in Black, and I say this a lot, and there can be more than one, but I think it's a perfect song. That song is a perfect song to me. I could be having the worst day of my life, and I'll hear that, you know, those first couple of chords come in, and I'll be fired up. I'll be ready to go. And the words, the lyrics are so tough. You know, the lyrics are so tough. Mm-hmm. Talking about how he's basically going to kick your ass, and I'm the baddest man around. I just love it. So I can get how people would feel that way. But I'm honestly with you. I mean, the albums I bought were the Bon albums. Yep. That's what really got me when I was younger. So you talked about how they felt when Bon passed. What about the effect on Angus when Malcolm had to finally step away in 2014? I think is when he retired, right? He kind of retired from the band in 2014. What was his mindset like then? I mean, I know they together they could go on after Bon, but now that he's by himself, was there a point when he was thinking, you know, maybe I should pack it in?
Yeah, well, again, it was one of those conversations. You know, Angus had asked Malcolm, you know, what should I do? In the same way that he and Malcolm had asked Bon's parents, what should I do? And Malcolm said, keep going. If you can keep going, keep going. Because, you know, once you've lived something like any band for 40 years, it's a very hard thing to shake. Mm-hmm. And particularly at the time when AC/DC were as big a draw card as they'd ever been throughout their career. It's a lot to walk away from. And if you look at that last tour, which was a bit of a disaster, you know, Brian Johnson, he lost his hearing, he couldn't perform anymore. Cliff Williams said, I want to retire. Malcolm had already gone. Yeah. Phil Rudd was in house detention.
Yeah, right?
It was chaos. And yet they somehow managed to find a way to not just stumble through it, but to keep playing to 50, 60,000 people a night with Axl Rose, you know. That is, as a matter of simple perseverance and commitment to the cause, it's unparalleled in rock and roll history, as far as I know. But it says a lot about, again, you know, I keep using the term working class, but it's a lot about that, is that you don't quit. You know, you don't give something up, particularly if you're in the middle of a tour. You know, Angus probably in his head went, if we cancel now, we're going to lose millions of dollars. It's a terrible look for the band. A lot of people are going to be disappointed, and a lot of other people who work behind the scenes are going to be out of work. He had to find a way, I think, in his mind to keep it rolling. And before that was the discussion with Malcolm. Do I keep the band going? And he said, if you can, why shouldn't you? You know. And the other interesting thing is Malcolm had a big, as we've discovered subsequently, seems to have quite an archive of riffs. You know, they've been using them and saying that even a lot of the new songs incorporate a lot of recordings that Malcolm left behind. Wow. So, you know, it wasn't like there was a shortage of material to work with. And let's face it, we're talking about AC/DC. We're not talking about the Beatles, you know. So it's a band that works within a fairly narrow perimeter.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he's got this material to work with and it fits, keep using it. I'm personally a little surprised that they've made a new record and it seems like they're going to bother to tour again.
Right.
Because I just thought, even though it was kind of chaotic, that last tour, it just seemed to me to be the end of the line. You know, Malcolm had died. George had died. You know, Bon was long gone, of course. Brian said he was leaving because he couldn't play anymore. Cliff had retired. It just seemed to me that there was nothing left but Angus. But somehow, and I don't know how, but bizarrely, he's got the pieces back together again. You know, Phil Rudd's out of home detention, so he can play again. Brian somehow miraculously has got some crazy biomechanic, I don't know what, hearing device, so he can actually hear himself sing again. And it looks like he's coaxed Cliff out of, you know, retirement in, I believe, in Florida, actually, you know, sunny Florida. I don't know what Angus has got on him, but somehow he's convinced them to keep going. You know, I was very surprised when I heard about that.
Well, you know, a lot of people who have never stepped on a stage or never played a note of music in front of somebody else say that kind of thing. You know, I mean, they say, well, why are the Rolling Stones still touring? Why are AC/DC still touring? They're old men. But in the very limited bit of experience that I have in that situation, there is nothing better. There is no better feeling than playing something to a group of people and having them respond to you and having them appreciate what you're doing. And I can see 100%.
100,000 people.
Yes. So I can see 100% why you're never too old to have that feeling. You know, never are you too old to get that feeling and that adoration from people.
What else would you be doing? What would Mick Jagger be doing if he was retired?
For sure. Exactly. He'd be gardening somewhere. I mean, what the hell is that? Nobody wants to do that. But
so, you know, I get that. And also, look, I think you probably find in the case of AC/DC, they made a new record because they probably owed the record company
one. Yeah.
You know, those kind of guys, that's how they think, you know. So there could be business decisions involved in it as well. But you're right. I mean, Angus is only, 65 now.
Uh-huh.
It seems in the rock and roll scheme of things, in this whole kind of crazy rock and roll world we're in now, that's not so old.
Know? And all that music is coming back. You know, the Def Leppards of the world and the Rolling Stones are still going around. That type of early 80s, late 70s, those revival concerts are big money now. They're coming back in. Journey's playing again. You know, Foreigner, Bad Company, they're all touring around. Why not?
Hang on, who's Journey's lead singer at the moment? Still the...
It's Arnel Pineda? Yeah, Arnel Pineda.
Yeah, I've seen it. Looks great.
Hey, if you close your eyes, they played here in Jacksonville, and I went up to watch them. If you close your eyes, it's Steve Perry. I mean, the guy sounds dead on. I mean, they did a great job. They found him on YouTube, and I looked at it and said,
I got to watch the documentary.
Yeah, that's how all of these people should be grabbing their... If you want that sound, find the guy on YouTube who did the absolute best cover of it and bring him in. Because it's worked beautifully for them. I mean, he sounds dead on. If you want to hear the hits, that's what you want. You want the hits. He's your guy.
That's right. There's still a demand. I mean, I think if AC/DC went out on tour and suddenly the crowds were diminished, that might be the point where they go, okay, you know, it's the end of the line.
Mm-hmm.
But you get the impression with Angus that he's, you know, I called that book Last Man Standing for a reason. Because I think he's gonna go out on stage.
Yeah.
You know, he's, God knows how old he's gonna be, but he's gonna play until he can play no more, basically. Although I've got to say, the knees must be in bad shape. You know, after all those slides and cartwheeling. I mean, I call it the dying bug. Mm-hmm. You know, when he lies on his back and spins around, got to be hell on the joints. You know, and he's not a young man anymore. You know, it's gotta hurt.
He's definitely
got to have the best chiropractor, I imagine.
I don't even know. I'm mid 40s, late 40s, and I don't feel that way. I don't know if I could do that night in and night out. So I've also had some discussions, Jeff, previously around the death of the rock and roll star. You know, in the last couple of years, you mentioned it. You know, Malcolm, George, David Bowie, Tom Petty, Eddie Money, Rick Ocasek, Eddie Van Halen. A couple of weeks back, all these people are passing, and the internet stardom age. We're not replacing these people. You know, those rock and roll stars are not being replaced. I really lament that personally. To me, it's very, very painful. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts because you've done a lot of these biographies on classic artists of in Australia specifically. But what are your thoughts on the death of the rock and roll star, the rock and roll musician? Do you see something on the horizon that gives you hope that that's going to come back, or is it going to just take a while before we see something like that again?
Oh, I don't think we'll ever see it again.
Yeah.
I think rock and roll, there's as long as there's people, you know, my generation and around who were, like I say, were brought up at that time, you know, like I said, it was so exciting to be in mm-hmm. Sydney in the 70s and 80s, all this rock and stuff, all these great rock bands were happening. I think there's always going to be, for as long as we are around, there's going to be a demand for it. But as far as it being a form that young kids now want to actually pursue. I have kids who are 13 and 15 and they've got no interest in rock and roll at all. I mean, they know a few AC/DC songs, but they'd much rather go and listen to whoever the current little guy is. There's a lot of littles in hip hop, you know, Little Wayne, Little This, Little That.
Yeah, right.
Running gag with my son. Who's the new little this week? They're not interested in rock and roll. It just doesn't mean anything to them. It's not a digital age, tech age, internet age music. It's from a certain time and place. And I mean, we're lucky enough to have had it. You know, I think it's like any great form. You know, if you look at his history, you know, classical music and it lasted for a certain period of time. You know, all these different movements, not just in music, but in art and film and all kinds of stuff. They all had their golden age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my favorite books is Easy Rider's Raging Bull, which is about the 70s in Hollywood when these outsiders were making these fantastic movies, sometimes using studio money, but really quite radical. You know, these weren't Doris Day, Rock Hudson picks. These were real movies with, you know, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, all these great players. I think music had that same, rock and roll particularly had that same time. And it was the time that I talked about, you know, the 70s and 80s, you know, that produced AC/DC, that produced, you know, give me a list, produced Van Halen, as we discussed before, produced all these great bands. But I really think there's just not the interest. There was a discussion here recently. We had our two big footballing code grand finals, right? And there's always, every year, there's a kind of running gag about, oh, God, who's going to be the halftime entertainment?
Yeah.
And typically, they might get someone like, not Midnight Oil, but or AC/DC, but someone of that level, because that's what the audience wants. But this year, they got acts that are really contemporary acts, which are basically young guys with a broken heart and acoustic guitar, or a young woman who's singing, you know, in the style of more like a Lady Gaga or something like that. And they just didn't fit. And everybody's saying, what's the point? You know, what's the point? We're not going to have what we need for those kind of events are the big events like you would have at the Super Bowl, which would be, you know, to me is U2, Tom Petty, Prince.
Right.
Three defining Super Bowl performances, you know.
Absolutely.
Big rock and roll shows. But we don't have that anymore because we simply don't have the artists to do who are interested in making that kind of music anymore. So, you know, to me it's now, it's borderline nostalgia rock and roll. It's almost like it's done. I'd love to be proved wrong. I mean, when I was at Rolling Stone, you know, and this is, 20 years ago, there was that revival with bands like Jet and the Vines and the Hives, you know, and also people like the Foo Fighters sort of came out of that and became big stars. So there was this moment of, you know, and a lot of Australian bands were involved with it. It seemed like suddenly something was really happening, but that just fizzled out. Electronic music became more prevalent, you know.
Well, it became easier to make music without talent. Quite honestly, it became easier.
I'm glad you said that.
I mean, seriously, it became easier to make. You don't have to be a good singer. You don't have to be Freddie Mercury anymore. We'll change the tone of your voice. We will auto-tune you. It'll sound ridiculous and robotic, but we'll get it there. You don't have to actually learn your instrument. You don't have to worry about creating your own licks. The guitar solo
it's
was gone.
It's kept Kylie Minogue in music for the last 40 years.
Yeah.
So when you make it
so easy to make music, it's like anything, right? When you make anything too easy, then nobody's interested in excelling at it anymore. Everybody put a guitar. When I was a kid, everybody had a guitar in their hand. They all wanted to be Eddie Van Halen. They all wanted to be Angus Young. That's what they were learning. They were just, they had a guitar and it was hard. It was hard to do, but it was worth it. Because you're right, you'd have girls. If you had an acoustic guitar and you could play four chords and act like you could sing, girls thought you were the greatest thing around. Now you just got two turntables and a MacBook, and suddenly you're the same thing. It's not the same thing, but I digress.
You know, I see films like Dazed and Confused, like the Richard Linklater film, or Almost Famous, and I'm immediately back in that mindset of being a teenager and in love with rock and roll, in love with music. You know, I mean, my tastes were pretty broad, but I guess you'd always say it was essentially rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'll ever see their likes again. But I think as long as there's a demand for it, those bands will continue working, creating, and maybe not creating new music, but certainly satisfying an audience demand. Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, here we are in the middle of this weirdness where everything subsequent to this year could be completely different. Who knows? You know, U2 might go out on tour and no one turns up. You know, who knows what's going to happen? So maybe it's the end of the road for all those rock nostalgia acts. I don't know. Oh. You know, who knows what will happen when AC/DC take this new record on the road. My gut feeling is that there's still a big demand for them. There's still a core audience. But in 20 years or 10 years' time, that's probably going to change. Yeah. To me, it's a historical period. You know, 60s, 70s and into the 80s was this. And maybe part of the 90s, if you look at grunge and so on.
Right, yeah.
It was just a great, great, productive and really inspiring time to be in a rock and roll band. I don't think that demand. And we're also, kids are looking for shortcuts too.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a musician. You know, you say, what did AC/DC, how did they become famous? Well, they played 200 shows a year for the first 10 years of their life. Are you kidding? You know?
Yeah. I'll put it on YouTube and see if, or I'll put it on SoundCloud and see if it gets, you know, 100,000 likes.
Yeah, I mean, record deals are now done without someone stepping foot outside of their bedroom. You know, they can get an international record deal on the strength of a couple of YouTube videos. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying it's different and probably not as – it's less likely that you're going to be able to build a solid career on the back of that. You know, AC/DC are a classic example of a band that did the hard yards, built an audience, not just in Australia, but then did it in the UK and then went did it in America. You know, right. They did it three times in their career, which, you know, to me, you look at it on paper and you go, are you kidding, man? That's exhausting.
Absolutely.
You know, but there was so many reasons why they pursued that, you know. So, but yeah, I don't think that would happen again. Who knows?
So I have two more questions, and I appreciate you spending some time with me. So my first question then is, these three men that we're talking about tonight, George, Malcolm, and Angus, they spent a lot of time together, you know, over the course of their lives. So it would seem like they kind of have a shared story in a lot of ways, but you have three individual books. So what can the readers expect when they're looking at the individual books on these people that they wouldn't get just in one shared biography?
Well, look, I called it my accidental trilogy because it was certainly, I didn't set out to write three books about, you know, individual books about George, Malcolm and Angus.
Right.
It was a practical concern. I'm a jobbing author and I'm trying to make a living. And I had publishers who were interested in, after writing the book on Angus, they wanted a book on Malcolm. And then they said, oh, actually, you should write a book on George too, yeah, you know, if you can. What I tried to do, Angus and Malcolm, it was a challenge because you're essentially writing the same story.
Yeah.
But, you know, as we've talked about, the differences in their characters, Angus being the showman, the guy, you know, the craziest, the oldest schoolboy in rock and roll, that was his story. Malcolm's story was more about behind the scenes, making plans, making maneuvers, plotting the band's future, hiring, firing, all that kind of drama. He was much more deeply involved. So that gave me a bit more to work with,
yeah,
telling the same story, but with different components. George was different yet again. So much of George's story happened in the 60s. His involvement with AC/DC was behind the scenes. And then his subsequent career, he was involved with a whole bunch of successful Australian artists, including John Paul Young, who had a huge hit with Lovers in the Air, which you may know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A huge international hit. That was George's signature song, if you like. He wrote and produced that song. So, you know, I had a broader palette. In fact, of the three books, the one on George, while it's probably not as globally familiar, was a much more interesting challenge for me as a writer because it's covered an expanse of 50 years. You know, it was very broad. Everything from Friday on My Mind all the way to Lovers in the Air. You know, it's a very broad expanse and with AC/DC stuck in the middle. So I just tried to reimagine each one from a different perspective. I mean, you know, I'm currently working on another AC/DC related book, which is also required, not about the Youngs, but it's given me the challenge of, okay, how am I going to reimagine this yet again? Yeah. But I've been lucky, you know. I worked with Mark Evans on his book, Dirty Deeds. I also worked with a guy called Michael Browning. These are ghostwriting jobs, who was AC/DC's manager from the early days, early 75, right through to Highway to Hell. So he was the guy in the really founding era of the band when they established themselves internationally. So I worked with him, and his book's called Dog Eat Dog. So I got a lot of insight into, you know, a mountain of information about how AC/DC, the machine that they became, how it operated. So, you know, I'm never short of material. I'm always, as a writer, have to be conscious of repeating myself. I certainly don't want to do that. Sometimes it's unavoidable when you're telling essentially the same group story, but it's always about trying to reposition the narrative, if you like, from the point of view of the person who you, Malcolm's case, Angus's case, George Young's case. Yeah. So it's just a writer challenge. I'd recommend everybody buy all three books if you could, please, because my kids, you know, they need to go to school.
Absolutely.
Well, but look, you know, to me, if you're a real music fan, the George Young book is, to me, because it's a bigger palette.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot more. It's a bigger journey, and it also gets beyond the confines of AC/DC. It's a bigger story. So as a writer, I thought that was, it was a bigger challenge, and I think it was a bit more satisfying just for me as a writer to be able to cover such a big story.
And honestly, to me, it is also, you're forging a path that didn't necessarily exist. I mean, everybody really knows Angus. Everybody really knows Malcolm. Everybody really knows Bon Scott. But not as many people are familiar with George and what his role was singly on his own and with the band. So I do think you are.
Even here in Australia, the response has been, wow, I didn't know he was the guy behind you know, all these artists and all these songs. So
And that's in Australia. Imagine that in United States. You know, that in Australia where he lived, you know, people don't know that as much. And here it's significantly different. My last question then. So what will, in your opinion, what is, it's been 47 years now. I know that because I was born in 73. So it's been that amount of time now. What do you think is the lasting impact of AC/DC when we look back on them in 20 or 30 years, when the band is more than likely going to be gone at that point? What will be their lasting legacy?
Look, a lot of black T-shirts. I've never seen such merchandising in all my life as a music writer. You know, the last time I saw them, I'm trying to remember which tour it was, I've never seen so much a big merchandising desk, such an industry.
Yeah.
I look, you know, joking aside, songs that will stand the test of time, you know, songs that we'll still talk about in 20 years, even if there are no rock and roll bands, there's still going to be a demand for it on radio and, you know, so on that is going to continue, I guess, for as long as there's going to be, like I said, as long as there's going to be people interested in rock and roll, nostalgia and so on, there's going to be an audience for AC/DC. Whether they're going to win over new converts in the future, I don't know. But just as an interesting and really classic case study in determination, commitment, steely determination. You know, Malcolm in particular was never took his eyes off the prize for his entire life. It was all about the band.
Wow.
It was all about their career. It was all about them reaching a big audience. It was all about them proving that they were much more than, if I can speak freely, a bunch of shit kickers from the suburbs, which is what they were growing up. You know, they had a lot to, there were chips on their shoulders, no doubt about it. I mean, they came, you know, they'd been brought up in a working class a housing estate in Scotland, in Glasgow, and ended up in pretty similar kind of conditions in Sydney. So they had a lot to react against. There was a really interesting some research done recently. The three young brothers are among the 50, I think it was the 50 richest Australian families. You know, they're worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Unfortunately, two of them aren't around to enjoy the spoils, but you know, they became fabulously wealthy. Not that that was the ultimate goal, but it was certainly a lovely byproduct of what they set out to do. So, you know, I don't know. I think as a working class kid myself, I think it's just a really, their life story and AC/DC's career, rollercoaster rider career is really a wonderful case study in rising above, you know, pretty meager upbringing and circumstances, and really becoming a global, you know, entity in the same way as, you know, think about, you know, Coca-Cola or, you know, a lot of people, like I say, you can't look. It's hard to go out on a day anywhere. And I'm talking about most places in the Western world and not see an AC/DC t-shirt.
Yeah, I mean, you know? I got one on
right now.
That's for sure. I got one on right now. And I think
I've seen so many shots of, you know, supermodels getting out of a limo with an AC/DC t-shirt. Everybody seems to have some kind of recognition of this band and brand.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what they've become. They've become a brand, you know, and that's a pretty remarkable achievement. You know, there's only a handful of rock and roll acts have been able to achieve that.
But I do think,
you know,
that
they even,
I do think that 50 years on, though, they may still be, you know, the Beatles are still picking up new fans 50 years on. And I do think that AC/DC will be picking up new fans at that point. All you have to do is put the needle on the record, as they say, play the music, and you will recognize the fact that what it brings out of you. I mean, honestly, I agree with you 100%. I think that the songs are everlasting. They'll be there forever. And for sure. Thank you.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it's interesting, too, that, you know, as my kids were growing up, the use of AC/DC songs in more recent, particularly animated films, like Despicable Me and stuff like that, they're everywhere. You know, they are just such go-to items for soundtracks now that you think that's going to give them an extra boost into the future as well, you know. And they sound great. They just work really well on screen and in the middle of a storyline. You know, to hear, I don't know, Highway to Hell or Back in Black or any of those songs, it just goes, oh, yeah, that works. That fits. So
you're absolutely right. You put Back in Black at the beginning of, I don't know, The Incredibles, and suddenly this whole new generation of young people are, what song is that? Because it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter how old you are. When those kick in, when those power chords kick in, you'll feel it. I mean, that's just the God's honest truth. You will feel it.
Yeah.
Again, thank you so much for joining us today, Jeff. I really appreciate that. Would you like to spend just another moment or two promote any other current projects you might be working on? I know that the Australia has had some pretty significant lockdown protocols as well. I don't know if you've been able to actually get out and do anything for the new book, but do you have anything else working on that you'd like to plug?
Nothing yet. No. I mean, I've been really heavily promoting the George Young book for the last few months. Mm-hmm. I've done it all from the seat that I'm currently sitting in, which is a very bizarre experience. Yeah. Typically I'd be traveling, Australia is a pretty easy country to get around as far as that's concerned, and I'd often do, library talks and get out to bookstores and things like that, which hasn't been possible. We're open a little bit more now. Mm-hmm. Our freedom of movement is, I think, much better than it is in the States. And there's zero cases of COVID at the moment within certain Australian states. So it's awesome. Really good.
Terrific.
But for a writer, yeah, it was weird for me because my general circumstances didn't change that much. I'm sitting here banging away on the keyboard 350 days of the year.
Yeah.
It was just that my kids were around suddenly. They were out of school. That was a bit different. But when it came to promoting the book, that was odd, but proved to be pretty effective anyway, which, the lazy side of me now thinks, oh, hell, I could do that every book.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. So it's been strange. So it's been good for authors too. I think a lot of people are reading more. So mm-hmm. as horrible as the whole COVID thing has been, it's actually encouraged people to read more, which I think is, always a great thing. So
at some point there is burnout for everything. There's Netflix burnout. There is social media burnout, especially. And every now and then you just want to have something familiar and just be able to crack that open and kind of go away for a minute. So I completely agree. Once again, everybody, those books are High Voltage, The Life of Angus Young, AC/DC's Last Man Standing, Malcolm Young, The Man Who Made AC/DC, and again, most recently, Friday on My Mind, The Life of George Young. And you can find those again at jeffapter.com.au and or amazon.com. Once again, thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate that and hope you're doing well and talk to you again soon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. So that was Jeff Apter. We talked AC/DC, and they really are. It's an eternal band, one of my favorite bands of all time. You really can't come in and listen to some of those songs, especially off of Back in Black, things like that. The first couple of power chords from Back in Black, to me to this day, makes me want to fight somebody. I mean, it's awesome, and it's super tough, super powerful. I agree with him about the Bon Scott years. I personally do like those more. I'm glad to know that there isn't necessarily, I mean, again, there isn't going to be the same thing as the Sam and Dave discussion with Bon and Brian, because Bon, unfortunately, he didn't quit the band. He unfortunately passed away. So, but it is very unique when a second singer can come into an already established, incredibly popular band and can continue that level of success, or even in the case of Back in Black, eclipse it. I think that was probably their biggest album of all time, was Back in Black. So it actually eclipsed any success that they'd had to that point. Those are incredibly rare and unique situations when that occurs. It just doesn't happen. Sting leaves the Police. The Police do not get better. The Police get worse. So, or the Police don't exist. So it is a story of perseverance, a story of just determination. And I'm glad that they were able to keep going. I am glad, honestly, that they put a new album out. If that's what they want to do, let them do it. Because I agree with Jeff, this may be the beginning of the end for the rock and roll cycle in music. And these guys may be the last on the wall. They may be the last ones defending the wall. And when they're gone, the hip-hop invaders or whatever the musical tastes are of the time, they scale the wall, and now they're they're writing the history. I'm not necessarily interested in that. But I guess popular culture is passing me by just like everybody else of my age. So I will say to them, to Rolling Stones, to any other band in that particular age bracket, if you want to keep making music, you want to keep touring, go ahead and do it. Do what makes you happy. There's nothing better than the feeling of getting positive feedback and reaction from people who are there who appreciate what you do. What are your feelings on that? I mean, what do you think about AC/DC? I don't think it's even arguable that they're the greatest band that ever came out of Australia, but they're one of the greatest bands that ever came out anywhere, personally. What do you think? You can drop us a line at our Gmail account, provemewrongcast@gmail.com. That's our email account. Let us know. Have you ever seen them in concert? Have you ever seen them live? What was it? What was the experience like? That's all interesting to me. If you want to also, you can contact us on Facebook or Instagram. Prove Me Wrong is the name of the program. Just look it up on Facebook. Drop us a line again. If you are just looking for opportunities to listen to the podcast, we are on really every podcast platform that you can imagine. Anchor, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, the Apple Podcasts. Anywhere that you find podcasts, you can find Prove Me Wrong. Like and subscribe to the page, and you'll be notified when a brand new episode is released. We typically release episodes every week. So every week, you can listen to a new and interesting discussion. Jeff and I were talking before the show started, and he had mentioned, you know, that he found it really interesting that my show kind of spans a wide section of discussions. And I said, and I told him, you know, I'm interested in a lot of things, and I'm not interested in being pigeonholed into one specific thing. I love paranormal, but if I talked paranormal every show, I would be bored very quickly. There's only so many times you can talk about a ghost and what you did in consecutive dates before you just get tired of it. You know, if all I'm talking are conspiracy theories, I'll get tired. I love talking music. I love talking health and wellness. I love talking to individuals who were put in a life-threatening situation and found a way out. Those conversations are what I want with the podcast, and hopefully you enjoy them as well. So if you're looking for, that is how you will find us on the podcast platform, any podcast app. You can find Prove Me Wrong there, like and subscribe, and you'll be notified when a new episode comes out. We're also on YouTube and Rumble. And if you can see here the scroll on the bottom of the page, rumble.com/ Prove Me Wrong or YouTube. Again, like and subscribe to the YouTube page, the Rumble page. You'll be notified when a brand new episode comes out. We have a video portion. So those of you who are on Rumble or YouTube right now can be watching me have this conversation personally with Jeff. You know, he and I have a Zoom discussion. You can see us talking. I think that is much more interesting than talking on the phone where I can't see his face. Zoom has been wonderful. Those type of video feeds have been great. So before I go tonight, the Prove Me Wrong podcast is brought to you tonight by Zendo Zone Citronella Burners from JT Eaton. And here's my own personal version of the Zendo Zone. That's Surf and Stan. They're shaped like fearless bug repellent tiki gods. So you see that? A tiki god. So let Surf and Stan, Hawaiian Howie, Luau Lily bring the islands to your backyard with Zendo Zone Citronella Burners. They use natural 3% citronella candles and incense cones. They're perfect for patios, decks, backyards, campsites, poolside, and more. You can enjoy the outdoors again. They are available on Amazon.com and at select Ace Hardware stores. If you don't have one at your Ace Hardware store, send us a line, let us know. We'll make sure that Zendo Zones gets in that Ace Hardware store. Go ahead and collect them all today. So for my guest tonight, again, Jeff Apter, jeffapter.com.au is the website. Or you can find his books on Amazon.com. This is Pete Lieb, Prove Me Wrong podcast. Once again, we'll talk to you again soon.